Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, what's going on, folks? It's Kurt Nachman. Got a special guest here today. Jeremy Eldridge is actually doing some work right now, so he's a giant slacker, or maybe I'm the giant slacker, but we've got Josh Inslee hanging out in the office with us today. What's going on, man?
Nothing much, just being me.
Just being you?
Yeah.
What does being you entail, Mr. Inslee?
Well, for those of you who are unfamiliar with me, I am a criminal defense attorney also in Baltimore City. And right now, I'm here today with you to talk about stingrays, cell site simulators, and other forms of clandestine surveillance, which are slowly but surely coming out of the shadows and presenting us with many, many issues that we have to sort out.
Yeah. So besides the being the thing that killed the crocodile man, what is it, Steve Avery? What's the crocodile? Steve Irwin. Besides being the thing that killed Steve Irwin, what is a stingray?
A stingray is one of many types of basically a cell site simulator. They come by many names: stingray, amber ray, Hailstorm, my personal favorite, the Dirt Box. And most of these things are manufactured by a company in Florida called Harris Corporation, and they're by and large a defense contractor. And what they do is they send out a signal that is the same, it's an identical signal that a cell phone tower would send out. Everybody knows you have a cell phone, you're driving down the road. So you're driving from Baltimore down to the beach, something like that. You can be on a phone call the whole time, and it's going to be you're going to jump from tower to tower. That's how phones are designed, pretty seamlessly, so that your call doesn't drop every 2 or 3 miles. Now, what a cell site simulator does is once when they know the number of a target phone, whether that be a phone that was taken in a robbery, is connected to a murder, anything like that, or is connected to a suspect that they want to locate. What they do is they have a program where they can put that phone number in, and that program will tell them who the carrier is. Is it a Verizon number? Is it an AT&T number? Things like that. Now, once they know, say, oh, it's Verizon, we'll use that as an example, then they can basically what the simulator allows them to do, we'll call it a stingray now for simplicity purposes, although, like I said, it could come under a different name. What that stingray does is that sends out a signal that's the same identical signal that a Verizon cell phone tower would send out. And as soon as that signal is the closest signal, then your cell phone is going to hop on to that simulator thinking that it's the next closest tower. And that's basically what it does. What they do is they bump your phone off the network, and they trick your phone into thinking they are the network, so your phone logs in.
So why do we care? Is like, let's just assume we're not attorneys and we don't deal with these issues, the legality of these issues. Why, if I'm like Joe Schmo on the street, why should I care if the cops are using this technology?
Well, there's a lot of reasons that you should be concerned. First of all, the technology is not such that they can hone in on a very specific phone number and that only that phone number will log in. The narrowest they can get when they send these signals out is by carrier. And the signal that comes out from this thing, right, is the actual strength is classified. But you can say it's got a radius of a couple of blocks. Now, the problem with that is if the police come into your block and you have a Verizon phone, you're getting bumped off the network first and foremost. Now, why does that matter? Are the odds that you're going to have an emergency where, at the same time the police come into your block, it's pretty long. Practically speaking, it's probably not going to happen. But they're conducting surveillance. And the problem, too, is it gets into more of a legal minutia, but they're conducting general searches. So they're going into a neighborhood, and they're basically, in effect, searching everybody's house because they're peeking into your house with this sophisticated technology and basically seeing what you got inside, whether that's a phone. In this case, that's basically what it is. So that's why your average man on the street should be concerned.
Isn't it also that the standards that are used to issue, it's not really a warrant that's being issued for these, it's something sort of that's a step below a warrant that they use a lot of times to get to utilize these devices? In other words, there's not full probable cause or something less than that.
Yeah, that's...
And the fact that the Constitution prohibits general searches.
Yeah, that old Constitution thing. Always getting in the way of a good police search. So, what they do is, there's been kind of a watershed moment in the last year or so where the Department of Justice has kind of accepted that this technology is starting to become old news, and the level of secrecy is going down about using it. And I'll say this right now. The latest and greatest in Stingray technology is restricted to military and what I would consider higher level federal applications. So things like NSA, CIA, FBI is probably getting the latest and greatest stuff. And those things can do a lot more than the stuff that's going to be authorized to be deployed to the local law enforcement. Now, the problem with this is before they had this moment of clarity where they decided the best route was to be more open about it, previous to that, their position was one of secrecy. So now you're really getting into a tangled mess of legal...
Yeah, black ops basically being run by the police department.
Yeah, by the good moral discretion of the Baltimore City Police Department.
Hey, we have a caller on hold. You want to hop in and take this caller?
Absolutely.
All right, let's see.
Hey, you online? Hey,
yeah.
What's going
on?
Who's calling?
I'm on hold. This is Eric.
You're not on hold anymore. Is this Eric?
It's from Baltimore, yeah.
Eric from Baltimore. So did you? I don't know if you got the gist of the topic, but we're talking about Stingray devices with Josh Inslee, who's our – we can't call him
an expert
because – well, you can't call him an expert under Maryland law, Maryland rules of professional conduct. But he has been quoted in the New York Times, in the
Telegraph,
the Telegraph of London, talking about the Stingray topic, as well as state and federal courts. So what's going on? What questions do you have for Mr. Inslee?
Well,
or for the show?
I would like to know, how did Mr. Inslee get so much information to do such a great job cross examining these officers to win this argument? It seems like such a novel argument. I can't even imagine getting up to date to do that so well. How are you able to do that?
Well, all credit to where credit's due. That would be Andrew Northrup. I actually got a robbery case, and Mr. Northrup, who's an officer of the public defender forensics, called me out of the blue, and he said, "I think you have a Stingray case." And, of course, my response to him was, "What's a Stingray?" He kind of explained to me what it was and basically how to issue spot for things like that. And basically you see things like, the police are looking for a phone and then all of a sudden they have it. And also things they use in their statements like, using a sophisticated electronic device, we're able to locate the phone in 123, Smith Street. There's only really one way that you can do that. So, so pretty much the reason I got an alert is because I got a phone call out of the blue from somebody who knew more about it than I did, and then alerting me that I had a case that involved it.
Drew's a smart guy, too. He's a super, super, super smart guy. So, the obvious concern we have moving forward is, number one, no judicial oversight of these kind of situations. And then number two, it's like, this technology's out there. It really does need oversight. And you've got, potentially, as does happen, not all cops are bad, but occasionally you'll get guys going off the reservation, which, you'll never want. If you've got somebody's ex-boyfriend or ex-girlfriend coming after you and you've got a cell phone and all of a sudden he's tracking you with a Stingray device because he has access to it.
Right.
I mean, that's why these things require judicial oversight. And that's why it's so vitally important that the Fourth Amendment is in place and it protects against general searches. So where do you stand right now in terms of the litigation of these things? I mean, has the Have you been provided additional information by the state moving forward?
Well, actually, you know, moving forward now, like I said, since this technology has kind of come out of the shadows, moving forward now, prosecutorial bodies in Maryland and other places are trying to basically tailor search warrants specifically for these devices. Say, look, we got a cell phone tower here. We can narrow it down to this neighborhood. There's only going to be a five-minute window where we really need to bump these people off the network and search for these houses, and we got these good reasons, and a judge can sign off of this and tailor search warrants. The main problem we have is in Baltimore, there's about a 6,000 to 9,000 deployment history that they have with this machine for old cases where they weren't as forthcoming. And now we're basically slowly discovering all these old cases where there may have been basically catastrophic discovery violations, and a lot of people are in jail right now. So that's the forefront. The future is actually the history. You know, going right back in there and finding out what it's done, because they've basically come clean at this point.
Yeah, I don't really understand. I mean, you see this all the time. I think it's happened with a couple different FBI forensic techniques where, you know, it comes out 10 years later and they go, oh, sorry, oops. You know, the science that we said was science really wasn't science. It was really junk. And, you know, you got people sitting in jail because of it.
Right.
But the government's unwillingness to sort of recognize the error of their ways, and it's always rather disturbing. So what's going on in the world of Eric from Baltimore?
Well, ask that question again. I'm sorry.
I said, what's going on in the world of Eric from Baltimore?
Oh, what's going on is it's Friday afternoon, and I don't feel like my work is slowing down for the weekend. So,
oh, I can't help you. I can't help you with that one. So,
yeah, but when do you guys start talking about Antonio Brown, as I was promised?
So Antonio Brown is apparently out. He's apparently out for the weekend. The Washington Post just came out with an article saying that he was benched for concussion-like symptoms. He hasn't gotten any better over the course of a week. So, you know, I don't know what kind of statements were made by certain Bengals players. They probably weren't under oath, so we can't hold them to any perjury charges. But
a certain Bengals linebacker has single-handedly dismantled the entire Steelers offense.
Yeah, so Burfict or whatever his name is. He's out for three games next season, which doesn't really help the Steelers. But I think Pac-Man's got some problems too.
They should force Burfict to play for the Steelers defense this weekend to kind of shore up their issues. But
yeah, I don't really like the Steelers this weekend, unfortunately. I mean, as much as I want them to win and move on to the AFC title game, I don't really see it happening. I think they're going to be outmanned and outgunned, and in Denver, yeah, on the road, which is a tough place to play.
And it's going to be, you know, you start off talking about the game, and the first thing you say is, well, Roethlisberger's starting, but it's a long shot that he'll actually finish the game. That's not projecting confidence.
No, not at all. So what do we
can
do
I just
we
say?
That,
I wanted to say of that. I was going to say of that hit that, you know, I'm one of these fans that I don't like how the rules have changed, but I understand. But now I think that hit is like the poster child for why we can't let people just hit defenseless receivers. That was about as gross a hit on a man's head as I've ever seen. What's that?
Yeah, it's like him and Ronnie Lott and Jack Tatum should all be lumped together. Because that's definitely at that level. I mean, it was a textbook dirty hit, you know, and that's why the rules are the way they are for sure.
Yeah, and the reason why it was a dirty hit was probably because of the fact that the ball went past him and then Burfict still took about three steps and whacked into him. You know, if it would have been all at the same time, he was getting the ball at the same time he was being hit, you know, that kind of thing. There's more of a colorable argument to say, hey, well, you know, I didn't know, you know, it was bang, bang, it happened in a millisecond, but, you know, the ball had already sailed past him, and Burfict took about three more steps and blasted him. I mean, there's not really...
Yeah, it's funny. You think
I'm a defense attorney. I mean, it's hard for me to defend the guy.
So the question is, when you see something like that, you know, legally speaking, do you think there's any criminal or civil liability associated with a hit like that? You know, or if you see something, you know, where it's just a clear hit over the middle, the ball goes by, it's an assault, right?
I mean,
two defense attorneys.
I feel like there's definitely an assumption of the risk type defense there. And besides, I mean, I assume all these guys just get workers' compensation for this type of stuff, but I don't even know how that works at a professional football level when their incomes are millions of dollars.
They do have comp. They have workers' comp.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're fully insured as well.
Well, you would think they'd be. Somebody's insured. May not be the players, but the team's probably insured. So, you know, as far as Freddie Gray goes, I guess everybody's heard about the recent development, basically punting the Freddie Gray case into perpetuity while some of these legal wranglings are worked out on appeal. I fully expect a judicial bench slap coming down from the Court of Special Appeals. And then we'll see, depending on the characterization of, you know, this opinion from the Court of Special Appeals, we'll see whether or not the Court of Appeals takes up the interlocutory appeal.
I have a question for you all on the Freddie Gray stuff. I think this is interesting. Did you all see the breaking news today about one of these jurors
they want to call this guy? Oh, where they were 11-1 or something?
Yeah. So do you foresee in any way any judicial action to try to get that reporter to give up his source? Or do you think that the judge will finally just let it be and not do anything about it? Because those jurors were ordered not to talk.
Order in and of itself was very shaky legal ground. You know, once the case is over, the jurors aren't really parties to the case anymore. It's not like you have a gag order and a pending case, and the attorneys are in there, and they're parties, and they have their clients, and everybody's part of the case. After a mistrial, your juror gets discharged.
They have a First Amendment right to speak to whoever they want.
I agree with Nachman on this one. And basically, I think it's really, are they calling his bluff at this point? You know,
well,
what's he going to do? Is he going to issue a contempt? It probably wouldn't go anywhere. It's going to muddy up these future jury trials if that needs to
be. I read the request. The quote that I saw in the paper a month ago after the trial was that he requested the jurors not talk to the media. He didn't order the jurors not to talk to the media. Now, I could be wrong about that. Maybe they misinterpreted it. Maybe they misunderstood it. From what I understand, several media organizations either have or will soon be filing a lawsuit to open the Freddie Gray file, court files, which are sealed. And I believe that's either been filed or working its way through the system or about to be filed. You know, and they've got their First Amendment legal teams that, you know, generally do a pretty good job and almost exclusively litigate First Amendment issues. But it was 20 or 30 media outlets that had joined together to file this lawsuit to open up the juror lists and the exhibits and, you know, some of the other materials that's been under seal. And some of that is probably a little aggressively under seal, but some of it is probably rightfully under seal. I mean, but I think if the jurors want to talk, there's nothing really that's going to stop them. So,
and what are they going to talk about? Honestly, they're going to say, you know, there are certain restrictions on how much you can use, you know, the mentality of the jury or things like that when you're in legal pleadings. So it can be these things where, oh, it was 11-1. Oh, it was one that, you know, this split, that split, and we were arguing this thing or that thing. Now, how much can attorneys then incorporate that in the future pleadings? I mean, that's a whole other can of worms because, you know, the courts are reluctant to get into the, you know, into the jury room too much because of its – nobody wants to see
how what do you all think? So, let me ask this question of you guys. If any of the other other than the officer that's charged with the homicide count, for any of the other officers, would you, based on now seeing that article, that they were very close to convicting for the, I guess it was malfeasance or whatever type of charge, would any of you ever consider advising your clients for the future trials? If you're offered this and it's probation, we should just take it, or would you still say let's have a trial, knowing that every trial is different?
Well,
yeah.
Think about it this way. If you – what? And I don't have a copy of them in front of me right now, but I can imagine that if you are 35 to 50 years old
and you have an otherwise clean record, that your sentencing guidelines on one count of misconduct are going to be probation or pretty much close to it. So what's your downside for going to trial? You know, you risk getting a trial penalty? Sure. But, you know, it's not like they said, oh, well, we were 11-1 for homicide or manslaughter,
right,
or something like that. That's something that can scare you. If they say we're 11-1 for, you know, reckless or...
Yeah, reckless endangerment.
Reckless
endangerment
or
mouth
or something like that. It's still worth it to...
I mean, the thing is, you know, these cops' lives are done. I mean, they can never go back to the street, number one. Number two, I mean, I'm not advocating one side or the other, but from their perspective...
I think you'd be professional.
Professionally, their lives are toast. I mean, they will never be able to work as a Baltimore City police officer again, number one. Number two, if they're convicted, they're losing their jobs, losing whatever pension they may have.
Yeah.
I mean, so really, there's not a lot of downside, I mean, unless you get convicted of a homicide count. There's not really a lot of downside to having a trial. So it's pretty clear that they, you know, if it's 11-1, I mean, I don't know. My experience has been, if it's 11-1 not guilty, usually when you get a second bite at the apple, the defense team is going to get that not guilty. Now, that's not necessarily always true, but, you know, I don't know. The question I really have is, how long is this process going to take? I mean, statutorily, they've got to have a decision made within 120 days to get this case kicked back from appeal. Do you think they're going to stick to their timeline, Inslee?
No, because, I mean, the problem is this. You're now in this mess of interlocutory appeals and everything else. I mean, all the officers are on bail, and time is on their side, frankly. So... You know, it's a burden on the city to have these cases open. It's a burden on the judiciary to have these cases open. It's a burden on the police department itself to have these cases open. It's not a burden on Caesar Goodwin. You know, it's not a burden on Porter. It's not a burden on Alicia White or any of these people. They suffer the least by having this go. And as their attorney, I advise them, like, look, there's no incentive for us to help this system along. You know, our incentive is to have this process drag out longer and longer and longer. You get further and further away from the incident. You know, the family is made whole by their civil settlement.
Yeah.
You know, and it just becomes old news. You know, nobody's going to care about the Freddie Gray trial in 2018. You know, it's just there'll be some other big crisis that pops up. Some other kid's going to get shot in the back by a cop. You know, it is what it is. It's a major city. These things happen on a pretty predictable.
Josh Inslee, optimist.
Well, I mean, it is what it is. It's not like we're out in Carroll County.
He's a realist.
This happened.
No.
Yeah, you know, if this was Westminster, you could say, look, something bad happened with this police, and there was a blow up. But the odds of it ever happening again or happening in the next 50 years are next to nothing. Baltimore's a major metropolitan area. It's got a lot of, you know, impoverished areas. It's got a lot of high crime areas. It got a lot of homicides. Like, something's going to happen to take the rage from this to move it on to something.
Here's my question. On a very practical level, as a former prosecutor, if I wanted a guy to testify, why not just dump his case and say you're not going to charge him? You've got his sworn testimony, so if he changes his story on you, you can charge him with perjury, right?
Sure.
And give him immunity and say, look, I'm not going to charge. I mean, I understand the whole federal immunity, blah, 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 blah. But I think the problem with the state is, like, they want to have their cake and eat it, too. And you know, the Constitution, thank God, prevents that, right?
Well, I mean, more on that note to having their cake and eat it, too. If you have developed a game plan where you're going to try Officer Porter first, and you're going to then – you're planning on convicting him, obviously – and then once he's convicted, you are going to then compel his testimony because you're going to argue that he no longer has this Fifth Amendment right because his trial's over and he's been convicted. And you are then going to compel him. If that is your plan, it might be a good idea when he is on the stand and in your closing argument not to call him a liar, because that is what we call in Maryland a statement, you know, an admission of a party opponent. So now in subsequent cases, the fact that the state's attorney's office has taken this position that this man is not credible, you know, what weight is all this testimony going to have in it? I mean, do we really think that Mark Zayon or Ivan Bates or Belsky or any of these guys is just going to, or Captain Flint, are they just going to not mention the fact that the state has, you know,
called him a liar?
I think he
was called a liar 30 times in closing argument. I think that was the head count.
Right. So, I mean, so to what's all this going to get you anyway? You're going to get a witness that you've already declared a liar in open court on the record. So, you know, you're trying to compel this testimony, and this testimony might ultimately be worthless, you know, in the long run, because you've made it worthless because you've called the guy a liar.
Well, it's funny, too, because I've said that the state's attorney really painted herself into a corner by charging it in this fashion, in such a public fashion, because now if you come back and you say, well, I'm going to dump two of these officers' cases and give them immunity and have them testify against the others, which is something that strategically she could have done from the beginning. I mean, prosecutors make that decision all the time to say, yeah, I'm going to cut this guy a break because I think person A is worse, and I need to go after person A, and therefore I'm going to have to cut a deal with person B. And when you do that in the beginning, when you've analyzed the case and thoroughly investigated the case, you know, it makes it a lot easier to come to that conclusion. But if you do it, you know, three quarters of the way through your case, you're like, oh shit, this isn't going very well. I better cut somebody some slack and get another witness because, oh, wait, I don't have any witnesses for this case other than this one co-defendant.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically flip-flopping on your trial strategy that you've made public, and that makes you look weak. It makes you look like you're dealing from a position of weakness, and it makes it look like your case is weak. That's the problem. That's the problem that they're facing. Now, I personally think that the state's attorney's decision to publicly – you know, indict these people or publicly declare their intention to seek an indictment was that very day a good idea. Now, when we're going to get to be in almost a, you know, we're almost a year later now, it's time to bring these cases to trial. You're right. She did paint herself in a corner. Now, the funny thing about immunity is, you know, on TV and in the movies, it's a good thing. But you'd be surprised, you know, the people that actually receive immunity usually don't want it. You know, they aren't happy to get it because immunity kills your Fifth Amendment right, as we know. So could they have just dismissed the charges, dropped immunity when some of these lower-ranking guys have been like, here's your immunity, here's your subpoena, you know, you're coming to court. You're going to testify, you know, and of course. It would have made things better. It would have made it better for Porter because what do they get from Porter? You know, no conviction, a tangled mess of appeals right now. They're going to push all these cases back into the summer, which is what they didn't want, which is why they set him in the winter in the first place. And you've already had to trash the guy. So even if they win, even if they get everything they want from these interlocutory appeals, guess what? You have a witness who you've already publicly defamed. So, I mean, what are you getting them a long run for? It's like there's no cohesive strategy for victory. You know, and it doesn't seem like there ever was one.
Well, that's always my concern. It's like, why didn't you think, if this guy was your key witness, how did you not recognize that from jump, that you needed this guy's testimony to prove the other people's cases? How do you not recognize that?
Well, here's
do you think the Constitution doesn't apply to you? I don't know.
Well, when you're scheduling these matters, and they're scheduled back to back to back to back, you have to understand, too, that even if he's convicted, it's not like as soon as the jury says guilty, your Fifth Amendment doesn't just evaporate. You know,
you have a right of appeal, your first right of appeal.
Appellate right. Now,
I have an appeal that's 18 months, we're 18 months out from my trial.
Yeah.
And it hasn't even been argued yet.
Yeah. Back in the good old days, the appellate process can last years. I mean, it's definitely quicker now under our current chief judge, and you know, that's good on her. You know, she gets all the credit for that, evidently. But, the problem is this. He's going to be convicted. What are the odds that if he's convicted for malfeasance or homicide or something, that his attorneys and the money behind his attorneys, which is the FOP and the Baltimore City Police Department, all these other people, you know, what's the odds that they're not going to file an appeal? Zero. They're going to file an appeal. They're going to say the actions as alleged, an omission as opposed to an average. I mean, they're going to want at least the court special appeals at a very minimum to say, yes, you can be found guilty of this through an omission as opposed to an affirmative action, all the same stuff they're arguing at trial. So for the state not to foresee that.
And, well, and not only, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head, though. There are some seriously complicated legal issues that are issues of first impression for the appellate courts in the state of Maryland,
right,
that will ultimately weave their way up to the Court of Appeals if there's a conviction.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, the reason why you have holes in the law is because state's attorneys don't charge cops like this for acts of omission. They just don't. I don't know. I think the whole thing is sort of a boondoggle, in my opinion.
But it wasn't very well thought out. And I understand that the decision to charge, they didn't have the luxury of time. I mean, it was literally a period of civil unrest, which even in Baltimore doesn't happen that often. But those decisions had to be made early. The public had to be braced for this stuff early. You know, you could have even said it at the press conference, you know, look, we're charging these guys. Now, look, down the road, we might have to dump one or two out just so people know right away what they're getting into. You know, when you say we're charging all six of them and we're gonna nail them to the cross, you know, you paint yourself into a corner. How can you come back then and then dump a charge, offer a guy immunity? Because when you null-cross the case and offer somebody immunity, you're basically saying you are never gonna face consequences for this. You know, we're gonna let you go scot-free. I mean, your reputation is tarnished. You're probably gonna get fired. But you know, as part of criminal law, you're letting them walk. So.
I'm not gonna give him such a free pass. I'm sorry. I think some of this, a lot of this stuff was foreseeable.
We all agree on that.
Okay. Because you could have charged two people, or you could have charged one person, and you could have given immunity to the other five, and you would have had the same net result if you just charged the driver with a more judicious set of charges, not so aggressive charges. And you tighten your case up quite a bit by offering immunity to the other, or giving immunity to the other police officers.
Yeah.
You really tighten your case up as a state's attorney. You eliminate a lot of the leaks, and then you don't look so dumb 6 months down the road or 8 months down the road when you're in this boondoggle of a situation.
And from a PR angle, if you charge two, it's a lot easier to come back later and say, oh, look, we've done this work. We've done this diligence. We've done this fantastic investigation, and we are now expanding the scope of who we're going to charge.
Absolutely.
We're going to add a third, or we're going to add a fourth. You start with six, and then you have to backtrack. It looks like you're letting people off. It looks like you're going soft. So, you know, and Kurt's right. A lot of this stuff was probably foreseeable. I mean, there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking that goes on, but the fact that he was going to take an appeal and not be available to testify a week after his conviction, that's eminently foreseeable. The fact that now, you know, this matter is going up to the Court of Appeals, and then in all likelihood the Court of Special Appeals after that, I mean, you got...
Well, depending on how it's framed,
depending on
the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, why not? You know, send it up to the Hague. You know, it's gonna go well. And the defense attorneys have nothing to gain but delay, and, you know, delay serves only one side, and that's the defense.
So Eric from Baltimore jumped off the line. He had to roll. But our call-in number is 657-383-0809, if anybody else wants to call in. The one other thing I wanted to touch on, there was an article that I happened to get quoted in, but I didn't know anything about it until yesterday. But apparently there is a criminal investigation ongoing into the former governor borrowing permanently some furniture from the governor's mansion.
I don't think it was borrowed. It was purchased. I think the crux of the investigation is, was it properly appraised for purchase?
Right.
And was $60,000 worth of furniture properly appraised at whatever?
$6,000 or $5,000 or something like that.
Less than $10,000, let's put it that, a couple of years after. And, you know, was that right, or is there some malfeasance, some fraud, I guess would be the word involved in setting this up? I think it's a non-starter as far as a criminal case. It makes great headlines.
I don't disagree with you.
everybody loves to kick O'Malley around in Baltimore. It's getting to be one of our oldest pastimes. But I think, you know, the problem that's going to come if you actually have to try this in front of 12 jurors is Martin O'Malley, by an extension of him, the party of Maryland, and the machine that is, are they going to be able to produce people who qualify as experts in the area of furniture appraisal who can come in and say, no, look, the furniture is worth $1,000, but it's not in condition. It's got a nick here, it's got a ding there, there's a rip here, you know, it's been banged into by a vacuum in the governor's mansion for 4 years, whatever it is, and create enough doubt that, you know, the state's going to have a hard time proving overt fraud, you know, probably. And remember, this is not the Maryland Attorney General's office. This is not the U.S. Attorney's office. This is the Anne Arundel County State's Attorney's office. In all due respect, they're not cut out for these sort of large-scale political brawls. I mean, they're going to have to assign this to a line attorney.
The poor schlock is going to get stuck going through 7,000 pages of emails. I mean, that was what I – it's going to be a document investigation, because the issue is there's, you know, either you have a smoking gun, which would be an email from the governor or the first lady saying, I want all this furniture devalued, or you don't. And if you don't have that smoking gun, I think it's a complete non-starter in terms of a criminal case, in terms of the evidentiary burdens that the state would face.
Yeah, he's going to come in and say, oh, here's an expert. This guy is going to say that all this furniture was worth, you know, $60,000, $50,000. And therefore, you know, something hinky happened, therefore convict them of fraud. Like you said, it's going to become a battle of experts. And
how do you say that beyond a reasonable doubt?
Oh, my God. Can you imagine getting jury duty and getting stuck in a one-month trial where all you listen to is experts talk about the value of a hutch? I mean, come on. this bed frame, you know, that's a nice one.
The Martha Washington bed frame.
Yeah, who cares?
You know. George Washington put his wooden teeth on this nightstand when he stayed in Annapolis in 1785.
I mean, quite frankly, O'Malley's he's term limited it out of being governor. He's not going to become president this cycle or not get any real traction. So, I mean, what's the point? You know, it begs for a resolution, you know.
Well, I was just sort of surprised that it didn't get assigned. I was surprised that it got handed over to Anne Arundel County and not the, was it Emmett Davitt, that's the state prosecutor's
well,
office.
You know,
because they're the ones that are sort of designated by the state constitution to handle those kind of investigations. And, you know, I don't know, maybe there was like a recusal or maybe they declined. I mean, we obviously don't.
We don't know.
We don't.
But, and of course, the state attorney's office, in announcing this investigation,
they didn't leak it to the Sun. I know for a fact that they didn't leak it to the Sun. The Sun
had found out through Public Information Act requests,
okay,
based on what the reporter had told me yesterday. So
it wasn't an affirmative leak. It was a
The
Sun did their job and they investigated.
They actually did some investigative reporting. Oh, did I say that? Sorry, Fenton.
No,
so
we love you, Justin. but the problem is, like you said, it begs for a simple resolution. Cut a check for $15,000. No admission of wrongdoing. Move on.
I think you hit the nail on the head too, where that is exactly the kind of, you say, all right, you know what, forget it. I'll give the state of Maryland $15,000. But you know, I think part of the Sun's article said it was a political witch hunt, which I guess I don't really think that's a good defense. in a criminal trial, I think a good defense is exactly what you said, which is the shit had scratch marks on it. You know, but I think. If I were the subsequent governor and I came in and my house was empty, number one, I would say, well, what's the deal? Why did this happen? And number two, I think it's your fiscal responsibility to at least look into it to see what happened and why.
Obviously there's a certain amount of furniture turnover here because the furniture was all purchased ostensibly for the O'Malley governorship.
Oh, it was?
It was purchased around that time. So, I mean, the governor's mansion
predates the purchase of this furniture, which would lead one to believe that somebody else took the other furniture.
Is this like the Ed Norris Baltimore City Police slush fund?
Be careful the stones you start kicking over. I mean, Bob Yarlick sleeping on a State of Maryland issue bed in his house. Bob and Kendall.
So I was wondering this. I mean, I saw all this stuff and I said, there has to be like a precedent for this. You know, the Ed Norris police commissioner slush fund that's been used for 60 years by different commissioners, and he just happens to get caught with his hand in the cookie jar and sort of run out of town based on that. Although not run out of town, doing his own radio broadcast. But
Run out of town into federal prison, but then released and then came back to town.
Right, right. But, is Paris Glendening sleeping on State of Maryland furniture at Eastern Shore House?
I mean, one would think that it is a political witch hunt. And not so much Glendening, but Earl. You know, Earl's the only Republican former governor. So, you know, is his house full of old Maryland State House furniture, too? You know, you'd think that that's a question that would be asked before they went after O'Malley. But you know what? Like we just talked about with Freddie Gray, you know, sometimes these obvious questions don't get asked. And, I am sure that the State's Attorney for Anne Arundel County has no desire to defame the good name of one Robert Ehrlich and accuse him of thievery and fraud.
As it unfolds, I think it'll be a really interesting story to keep an eye on.
One thing that we can be sure of is that when Governor Hogan leaves, he will only be taking his old, his University of Maryland sweatshirts or wherever it is, and then he's going to leave a lot of that stuff behind.
Well, it looks like we are actually running out of time. Josh, thanks for joining us today. Hopefully Jeremy will get his work wrapped up and join us next time. And that's it. We are out.